Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we started our conversation with Dr. Bradley Onishi on soulmates. He is the author of What's Behind the Belief in a Soulmate that appears on theconversation.com. A little bit about Dr. Onishi. He is a teacher at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. He's on sabbatical right now. He holds degrees from Azusa Pacific University, Oxford, and the University of California, Santa Barbara. The courses he normally teaches include God, Sex, and Love in the History of Christianity, Religious Approaches to Death and Dying, Reenchantment and the Secular, Religion and Politics in Contemporary American Society, Atheism, and Comparative Mysticism. His research is focused on two distinct but related areas. In the first instance, he explores the resonances between the Christian mystical traditions and contemporary philosophy. This has resulted in two volumes, Christian Mysticism, An Introduction to Contemporary Theoretical Approaches, and Mysticism in the French Tradition, that bring medieval mystics in conversation with modern philosophers. So once again, we welcome to Common Threads, Dr. Bradley Onishi. Hello, Brad.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
Certainly. So for people who may not have tuned in last week, I think we can capsulize things fairly well. We spoke about the idea of soulmates, the idea that as a concept, it is growing in American society, that more and more people are believing in the existence of a soulmate, that there is the one out there for them. And then we went back and studied some history, and you enlightened us with the understanding that in medieval Christianity, there was a very powerful movement among celibate monks, mainly, that used erotic language to describe the relationship between the divine and humanity. Was that a fair summary?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to the story, but that's a pretty good summary.
And when you were saying that last week, just as we were closing, it certainly occurred to me that this is not exclusive to Christianity. Now, you were saying also last week that the Jews interpreted the Song of Solomon to represent the relationship between humanity and Yahweh. And then when the Song of Solomon became part of the Christian canon, it was used to talk about Jesus and his church, right? Using this, again, rather lusty language to talk about essentially the peak experience of being united with one's Messiah, one's Savior. So right away I'm thinking, well, boy, you go into the Sufi tradition in Islam, you will find that, and certainly the Bhakti traditions of Hinduism. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I will say just, you know, as a disclaimer, my scholarly expertise is really in the Christian mystics, and it does extend a little bit into the Song of Songs and the Jewish tradition. You know, I'm in no way a sort of scholarly expert on the Sufi tradition or the Bhakti traditions. I am particularly interested, though, however, in the Sufi tradition because it does come from, of course, another monotheistic tradition. So we have in Sufi mysticism and Sufi Islam, right, an expression of passionate love as a way for understanding the human divine relationship. For me, that's important in a kind of, you know, larger, you know, project that I'm doing, because it really shows us that the idea of the one true lover who can complete you, who can make you whole, who can make you yourself, give you your identity for the first time, right, really comes from the one. And for me, what's fascinating is that we can kind of map this monotheistic legacy onto what we now know is a kind of monogamous myth. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is one of the ideas I want to put forth is that many folks who would never claim to be monotheists, right, and yet who believe in the romantic one, are unaware that they are framing love, their monogamous idea of love, as a kind of monotheism. That when you're putting forth the idea that your soulmate completes you, makes you yourself, and is the only one who can make you happy, well, you're reiterating sentiments that originated in the Abrahamic traditions, Jewish, Christian, and you just mentioned locales in the Islamic tradition. And so what's happening is a transposition of religious ideas and religious myths into a kind of secular or non-religious register where monotheism is considered monogamy. Monotheism is rendered in a kind of monogamous register. And monogamy, if we look back on these traditions, is really kind of constructed as monotheism. The two go hand in hand in a way that I think informs our contemporary idea of the soulmate.
And if I may offer something, because we have had guests on this program who've talked about the bhakti tradition in Hinduism, and there may be many more. The Sufism in bhakti just came into my head right away. But the devotees of Krishna hearken back to a myth that you might be aware of where Krishna he was in love with Radha, a cow maid, and her friends, who were also cow maids, they all fell in love with Krishna. And oftentimes, that tradition espouses that we are all the cow maids, and Krishna is the divine one, and we long for that relationship with Krishna. So I think the two are not dissimilar, really.
I think there are important resonances there. And the way you've outlined it is very similar to kind of how I was sort of thinking about what happens in the Abrahamic traditions, in the sense that, you know, in a very important way, the divine one becomes everyone's romantic one, right? Well, what does that mean? It means that if we are all the cow maid, well, what it means is that my soulmate is the divine one, and it doesn't matter that the divine one is everyone's soulmate, right? That's kind of how the sort of structure works in these religious contexts.
Yeah. One of the stories is that Krishna was dancing with Radha, and all the other milkmaids were so sorrowful and jealous, and all of a sudden, 400 Krishnas appeared to 400 milkmaids and started dancing with each and every one of them. So
that
I think that works. I think we can put that together.
No, I think it does. Yeah, that makes sense.
So last week we were talking about this phenomenon that is rather apparent here in contemporary society, where people are believing in the concept of soulmate. And I'm wondering if we have any data to judge whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in terms of unrealistic expectations or honest expectations in terms of what to expect from a soulmate. If one believes that it's this person who is going to make them happy, as opposed to having happiness being something internal, I'm concerned that might be a recipe for disaster.
I think you're right. And so let me just say that there is some data, right? If we go back to the Monmouth poll that I mentioned last week. So I mentioned a Monmouth poll that tells us that 2/3 of Americans believe in a soulmate. And that's from 2017, so it's fairly recent. If we go to that same report, it seems that the data tells us that those who are sort of deeply invested in this idea of a soulmate are more easily kind of dissatisfied with the relationship and actually more in danger of breaking up because, and I think this is a kind of plausible conclusion, they have such a lofty ideal of what love is that, you know, when a relationship doesn't go exactly how they might think it should, they conclude, well, this person must not be the one because things have not gone like they should have. And so I need to sort of break this off and go find my true, you know, ideal soulmate, the one for whom I'm destined, right? Mm-hmm. On a conceptual level, I would attribute that to this idea. It's one thing to think that your God can provide you with all of these following things: happiness, selfhood, destiny. Okay, if you pin your hopes for those things on a transcendent deity, that makes sense, right? Even if one doesn't, you know, believe in that deity, one might sort of be able to think themselves into that situation and think, if there really is a God of that kind and that nature, then that God probably could provide happiness and selfhood and completion for an individual person. Well, if you transpose those hopes onto one singular human, it seems to me that you are destined, no pun intended, for disappointment. That if you pin the hopes of the divine one onto the romantic one, that no one single human person is able to kind of carry that kind of burden. One of the ideas we get when we think about the soulmate in a religious context is that it makes us believe that love is about saving and being saved. Again, that might make sense if you're talking about a relationship with an all-powerful God. But if you're talking about one human person saving you, or if you being in love with another and you're talking about saving them, that seems misguided. That seems to be a recipe for dissatisfaction at best and disaster at worst.
At the same time, it's interesting because I think you can reverse this. I'm recalling a conversation I had with a woman who she has now regained a sense of spirituality, but it is so different from the spirituality with which she was raised. She had this understanding that if she did all of the right things, the one, the divine, that soulmate would provide a really, really excellent life. And so she went about doing all of the things that one supposed to do, in quotes, of course. And then she had a situation, it was a sibling died, a sister died. And she was devastated because she thought, wait a minute here, God did not keep his part of the bargain. You know, I've gone to church every single Sunday. I've tried to follow the Ten Commandments. I do all of the things that I was told would give me a good life. And now my sister at a young age, of course, not a sister who's 95, my sister at the age of 16 or 20 dies. That's not fair. He can't be the one. Which I always find fascinating. How do you live in a world and not see the tragedy that people undergo all the time who are supposedly following the rules? The relationship just doesn't work that way. But in the same way people can have an unrealistic expectation for their lover, they can have an unrealistic expectation for God, I'm assuming.
Well, and, you know, this points us to a kind of separate issue, but one that's related, right? That, you know, if you believe in God, in a monotheistic God, et cetera, this is a classic problem of evil that, you know, can you go on believing in that God when bad things happen, when you have a spouse die, you know, when St. Augustine's friend dies, he sort of questions. He says, I became a question to myself. And kind of implied in that is, God became a question for the first time. Can I still go on believing in that God, right? And so one thing that happens for Christian and Jewish and Muslim folks who believe in a monotheistic God who is all-powerful is, you know, how does one sort of go on living in a universe where evil exists? And that is a complicated struggle, right? And it often sort of leads folks who persist in their faith to take a much more complex and nuanced vision of themselves and of God, right? Well, if we're talking about a romantic one and a human person, I think that means that we might take a more nuanced and complex vision of what human love might be. And we might have to admit that the idea of sort of destiny and completion is just not, it sounds nice in concept, but that's just not how life works in reality. And so there has to be a kind of more complex understanding of the work and the cultivation that happens in long-term relationships between human beings.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today we're talking about the cosmic concept of the soulmate. And with me is Dr. Bradley Onishi from Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. Although he's actually talking to us from California because he's on sabbatical, but that's a whole other issue. Are you enjoying your sabbatical?
I am, very much. I'm it's nice to have some time and space to really think and write and do some research. So it's really good.
Excellent. So in talking about this, the realistic versus unrealistic expectations of a soulmate, I want to ask a question. I don't know that you will know this if you have the data to support this, but let me give you something I've observed, but I have no science to back me up on this. Today, there are a lot of people doing relationships wrong. That is to say, people who get involved in toxic relationships, people who are afraid to commit, people who are afraid to, there's abuse. We still have a pretty significant failure rate with marriages. At the same time, what I observe is that people, and I'm talking about anywhere from the boomers to 10, 20 years under that, the people who are doing it right in terms of being a good spouse and being good parents are doing it righter than previous generations. When I look at my friends who are parents and partners, I see something that is just beyond what I see in my parents' generation. That the spouses are much more friends with one another, and their parenting ability is less authoritarian. Admittedly, sometimes it can go all the way to just ridiculously permissive, but nonetheless, I see stronger relationships between parents and children, and stronger relationships within the marriage itself. Keep in mind what I said before, those who are doing it right, not the vast number of people who are doing it wrong. Can you comment on that? Do you have any point of view on that?
I do. There's a lot of work on this sort of sociologically and historically. And what that work shows us is that in the mid-20th century, there was kind of a revolution, right, where what became constitutive of one's life was love, not marriage. What I mean by that is marriage became a choice, right? In the mid-20th century, with the sexual revolution, women joining the workforce, more women going to college, and just an overall change in our social, political, cultural mores, what we have is the fact that you don't have to get married to be socially acceptable. You don't have to get married to be professionally successful, right? That marriage becomes a choice. And so the divorce rate skyrockets, right, in the sort of 60s and 70s. Why? Well, because a lot of people woke up to the fact that they were in really bad marriages that they didn't want to be in, right? And you had all these folks sort of proclaiming the end of marriage and, divorce is on the rise and it's all the fault of the hippies and the sexual revolution and everyone else. Well, what's happened since then? What's happened since then is kind of what you're saying, Fred, is that those who are getting married, now fewer people are getting married than perhaps, 50 or 75 years ago, but those who are getting married are often sort of having success in their marriages, meaning that the divorce rate has gone down. When I tell my students that the divorce rate in 2019 is actually less than it was in, say, 1978, they kind of look at me funny. They don't believe me. Well, one of the reasons is fewer people are getting married, but those who are getting married are doing so on the basis of a carefully worked out partnership based on love. And so the marriage is a result of love. It is not the fact that love might be an optional or additional part of the marriage, which is how it used to be, right? Now, that goes hand in hand with the development of what sociologists would call the companionship marriage, right? That marriage has really become about sort of a lifelong partnership with your best friend, that you are partners when it comes to everything from economic decisions, professional decisions, minute things about what to eat and how to spend your time, and then goes all the way to how to raise your kids, right? And so the kind of freedom we have socially and culturally to kind of create ourselves and our identities in the 21st century means that those partnerships are kind of carefully worked out, you know, balances on the part of two people. Well, the research shows us a couple of things, right? One is that means fewer people are willing to get married because fewer people think they can find that really nice balance. Two, this works really well for those who have the means. And so if we look by a measure of affluence, those with enough means to find this time and balance for professional life, for private life, for social life with friends, for hobbies and relaxation and wellness techniques. If you have the means for all these things, you can often create a very, what we might call, quote unquote, successful partnership or marriage. If you don't, right, it might be more difficult. And so all that to say, there is some research to back all this up. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it in historical context.
I'm wondering, this just struck me. Do you think that there is a relationship between this newer concept of marriage and the decline of fraternal organizations?
What do you mean by... So when you're thinking of fraternal organizations, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking, you know, Lions Clubs, the Moose Club, the Elks Clubs. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those male only bastions, which were really, really strong all throughout the 20th century, and now they're in significant decline. The Shriners, as well as the Shriners come out of the Masons. Thank you. The organizations are in decline, and I'm just wondering if men are marrying such wonderful women who really do complete them, they might not feel the need to, like, get out of the house and get away from the little woman and, you know, hang with the guys, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's part of a larger context. That goes something like this, that, you know, there used to be this idea of a kind of separation of the sexes that, okay, so there used to be, let's just go from the top here. Marriage used to be between a man and a woman exclusively. It used to be a heterosexual and heteronormative institution. It's no longer that. Within that heterosexual sort of heteronormative institution used to be the idea, and this is something that can be traced back to the kind of beginnings of the 20th century, that the domestic domain was the domain of the wife, and that the professional and public domain was the domain of the husband. And so with that kind of strict idea of the separation of the sexes, you had the idea that the man would provide professionally and socially, the woman would take care of the domestic space, and thus the goal was really not to be friends, to be sort of people who spent all day, every day together, discussing everything from what to eat for dinner the next night to who's the best political candidate for the 2020 election to, what should we do about this sort of local school board issue. That was not the model of marriage. It was not a companionship marriage in that sense. And so you're right. Men would often abscond at night to a kind of homosocial context, a place where it was all guys playing poker, going to the Elks, whatever may be, right? You do see a vast decline in that because that whole model, that whole binary, has really been deconstructed. Marriage is no longer exclusively for man and woman, and marriage is no longer really required for people to live together and share a life together. Furthermore, the ideas of domesticity and professional public sort of domains has really broken down. It's just not a kind of model that Generation X or Millennials or Gen Z really follows. And so it really does make, I think, the kinds of organizations you're talking about something that is a thing of the past rather than a thing of the future.
Brad, we are down to the wire for this edition of Common Threads. I want to thank you so much for your time with us both today and last week as well.
Thanks for having me, Fred. It was a great conversation.
Certainly. If people are interested in following you, do you have a website?
I do. You can find me at bradonishi.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Bradley Onishi. And I'm actually in the process of working on a book about all these ideas that we've discussed today. So if you're interested, please check those places for news and updates about what might be coming in the future.
Great. And your last name is O-N-I-S-H-I.
So that's right.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. And with me today, again, Dr. Bradley Onishi. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.